with Juan Gonzalez.
From the roots up, CIUT 89.5 FM. Toronto.
Welcome to the Tater Report, CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto. And we're going to be talking to David Sobel, who is a proprietor of a site called themovingpast.com. If you want to look ahead and see what David has been up to, you can do that by way of preparation. We'll be talking to him probably at the halfway point. We have news that we want to talk about. I want to say some things about Christopher Black, who has died, and too early, a wonderful individual, be coming up. There's going to be a webinar, How NATO and G7 Dominate, and that's going to be, I'll read the whole thing, How Imperialists Use NATO and G7 to Maintain Global Domination. That's going to be Tuesday, June the 10th, 4 p.m. And it's going to have Tamara Lorenz as one of the speakers, Owen Schalk, and Barbara Walden. And you can go to peaceandjusticenetwork.ca or to the Hamilton Coalition Against the War. Get the details. That's going to be Tuesday at 4 o'clock. Pacific time, pardon me, and it's 7 p.m. Eastern time. And a little subhead is Canada out of NATO and G7. So there it is again, Tuesday, June 10. And it's a webinar. You can go to those sites, peaceandjusticenetwork.ca and the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War. You get all the information you need. And there's important news that at 6 p.m. today, Monday, there is a demonstration at Bloor and University at the near where the Israeli consul is, because the ship, they're trying to bring food and medicine to the people of Gaza, has been boarded by the Israeli forces. As you know, their camp, it's just a hideous situation. Canada will have very little or nothing to say about it because they are aiding and abetting the Israeli leadership, Mr. Netanyahu, in a project that has been condemned worldwide. So 6 p.m., protests against the boarding of the ship carrying Ms. Thunberg, I believe her name is, I hope I got that right. She's a prize winner for peace and on ecology. By the way, she chose the wrong topic, because now the Western imperial powers have changed their minds and they don't care about ecology anymore. There's no more global warming. Everybody's going to go for coal. Everybody's going to go for gas and step it up. It's an ugly situation. And she, by the way, she was the face of the movement to resist that. They've pretty much decided to change her profile because she spoke out against the bombing and attacks on Gaza, which are illegal, by the way. There's no disputing. Gaza, it doesn't belong to Israel. And if they're in Gaza, they are an occupying force. They ignore all UN resolutions, so it's quite serious. Canadian people know that. Toronto Star, Globe and Mail do not know it, but they, the Canadian people know it. So today, 6 p.m., there'll be a protest. I want to thank Brendan Stone for calling my attention to this fact. Moving to the issue or sadness of the passing of Christopher Black, a Toronto lawyer who distinguished himself on the international stage by fighting to defend accused in tribunals that were, I guess we call it lawfare, but it the great powers to justify themselves for bombing Yugoslavia and eventually arresting and charging the president of Yugoslavia. It was simply a political exercise to justify their aggression against that country. In many ways, you could say that what is happening now in Ukraine is pretty much a direct result of that decision to go on the offense and break up and divide countries, with the U.S. being the prime force involved. By the way, the German Air Force was used for the first time since World War II outside the country, which they have a constitution that says they're not supposed to do that, but they very happily did. Chris Black distinguished himself by speaking out about this both as a lawyer, but as also a political analyst. His writings are excellent. We've had him many times on the show. I am very sad to be talking about him because I had anticipated we'd be having him on again sometime soon to help us understand what is going on, and particularly with the NATO move to get more deeply involved. I don't know how it's possible to get more, but they are. They're increasing their participation in the Ukrainian conflict. Chris was very vocal and very well informed about this. If you want to know, and you may remember Chris being on the show, he took on a case which involving Rwanda, which we speak of on the show often. And his client was General Augustin Dindilimana. I had the pleasure of knowing the general, he's with us, and he's I wish we could speak to him, but he's not confident of his English. But he was a Rwandan general. He was head of the gendarmerie of Rwanda. And he, just to outline it and how important it was, the work of Chris Black on this case, General Dindilimana had left Rwanda somewhere near the end of the conflict between the armies. That would be the army of Paul Kagame and the RPF, who are now, by the way, fighting in East Congo because they want the minerals there, and their backers, U.S. and others, help them because they also want those minerals. But at any rate, Paul Kagame's army and the Rwandan army engaged in a war between, it began in 1990, but then there was a peace process, and then that was ended when the president was assassinated in April 1994, and the country found itself in a really hideous situation where there was ethnic expression of the war, depending on which side you were, civilians attacked each other. And the U.S. and, to a lesser extent, France, Belgium was a big player, the U.K., supported the RPF side. And General Dindilimana was regarded throughout this period, from April through July, as a level-headed, soft-spoken, able a general of the army. He cooperated with UN forces who were there, though depleted and largely useless. And near the end of the conflict, he left Rwanda, and he was welcome in Belgium. And Belgium regarded him as a someone who had only done his duty and had not committed any offenses, and they actually, he was appreciated, you could say. So he went to, others were charged. By October of 1994, the charges were being laid against one side in the conflict. That's why Ramsey Clark referred to it as war by other means, because instead of investigating who had committed and caused violent massacres of civilians, they'd only look to prosecute one side, and that would be the losing side in the war, which was immediately, anyone looking at it would say that's not a proper approach to criminality during a war. If you're going to pick out people to accuse, you have to examine who were the participants and open the possibility that there might have been crimes committed on either side. So the prosecution was of Rwandans, largely Hutu leaders. And so they charged, most famously, a man named Bagosora. Bagosora was kind of the poster boy. I was there, as listeners will know, I worked there. And I was in a press conference in probably 1997 or 98. I can't actually specifically recall, but the media was unhappy because they wanted a glamour villain. They didn't, so far, they only had people that nobody had ever heard of. But the name Bagosora was somewhat well known because he had a certain political visibility and military role, or so it was thought. And he was apprehended in Cameroon. He never had a due process. I think it was Cameroon. It might be another country in West Africa. And I saw at the press conference, the president of the court, Judge Kama, was talking to reporters, and reporters said, you know, when are you going to get this court going? You got a court, but there's nobody here that anybody knows anything about. And he said, well, now it's going to become more interesting, because he said they've arrested the big fish. If you were a lawyer, any self-respecting lawyer, and you hear your client referred to by a judge as the big fish, you know that you're not in front of a real court, because what you're in front of is some kind of play-like court or theater court or show trial. Bagosora was convicted out of the mouth of the judge through the media without being in court, without being presented with evidence, et cetera. I don't want to go on and on, but just to show you the kind of, okay, that's the backdrop. So General Dindilimana, Chris Black's client, was on the opposite side of this. He was regarded, rightly, as somebody who was shocked by the death of the president, found himself in a situation where society dissolved because of the breakout of the fighting, and he did his best. So that was the general consensus. So he was in Belgium. I visited him once in Belgium when he was free and just there. He was open, by the way, to approach by the Belgian Senate, and the French. They were all investigating. Both the French and the Belgians had personnel in Rwanda. The French lost some civilians killed there, by the way, in the first days. Only when I'm speaking do I remember that. The two French individuals who were killed by the RPF. there was never any justice for them that I'm aware of. So General Dendelimana was there, and he was in Belgium and cooperative and friendly and open and not accused by anybody. And the trials began in Arusha, Tanzania. But a journalist whose name I can't recall made some comments about events which were quite inaccurate and inflammatory about what had happened. And the general was moved to write a letter, public letter, saying that wasn't true, it wasn't accurate. And all of a sudden, the enthusiasm for him declined. And then they began to talk about, well, maybe we should look at him. And eventually, they decided they would charge him. And so this man, who had been regarded as one of the decent, fair, law-abiding officers, found himself accused by the tribunal. And it was clear to anybody watching, and you go to Chris Black's, there will be many opportunities. I think he gave speeches, he wrote about this, he was interviewed many times, but they wanted to use General Dendelimana to testify against the other officers of the Rwandan army. But he wouldn't do that because, of course, that would involve telling stories that weren't true. He was a truthful, is a truthful individual. So those of us who were part of the defense approached Chris Black, and he was the ideal lawyer to turn to, the ideal caliber. He was a criminal lawyer, and he didn't, as a criminal lawyer, and that's why I love criminal lawyers as opposed to political lawyers, or lawyers looking for something special for some little cause. He, like a good criminal lawyer, worked on the presumption of innocence, and he didn't believe that he was part of some great international mission to bring justice, true justice, to Africa. Louise Arbour, Canadian judge, was quite famous and everyone fond of her, so they tell me. She said that in opening the court, her first speech was that they're going to end the culture of impunity in Africa because something about Africa makes them, she seemed to be suggesting, inherently corrupt. And the ICTR, International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, was going to be a show the Africans how it's done. She is also the one who said when Milosevic was negotiating peace in the former Yugoslavia, when he was, of course, the president, he was negotiating, making an attempt to have a peaceful transition or resolution of the conflict between the various nationalities or ethnic groups, or to use that word. Louise Arbour said, well, you can't talk to him because we're accusing him of war crimes and genocide, crimes against humanity. So it was a leverage argument used by the Clinton administration to say, oh, you see, we can't talk to Milosevic because he's a criminal. Well, that, of course, we see it today almost everywhere, where you label your opponent, put a label on him, which hasn't been demonstrated, and then you use that as an excuse to try to remove that person and prevent their doing their job, because he was the president of Yugoslavia. And so it was politics. There's no other word for it. That's politics. She had no business talking about whether or not he was a criminal. She could say it's my job to prosecute and see about the facts, but she's interfering to suggest that you can't talk to him because that's not her territory. She can go ahead with her investigation, go ahead with her charges. But meanwhile, you had a need to create a nonviolent resolution to a conflict which has cost thousands and thousands of lives. But they created the tribunal for Yugoslavia and for Rwanda as basically a device to bring about a political resolution. And they wanted to, of course, they gave these things high-minded labels. We're going to prosecute genocide and we're going to bring human rights and all these things. And most lawyers who were originally attracted, or many of the lawyers, not most, not Charles Roach, not Ramsey Clark, not David Jacobs, not Michel Marchand, most of the lawyers who were originally attracted said, I think it's a great mission. This is a wonderful idea, but you know, the tribunal, but I will be defending this individual saying he didn't do these things. But a criminal lawyer, a proper one, such as Christopher Black, who died only a few days ago, his approach was, my client is innocent. You're going to have to produce evidence, and we will settle this in court as to guilt or not. But he didn't kiss the Blarney Stone, which was what makes a court work. The defense counsel, some of them, would come to court and say, oh, it's such a wonderful thing. We're all against genocide, and it's, you know, this is a noble exercise. I'm going to separate that again. Criminal lawyers said, I don't know whether this court is properly constituted. I don't know that it's on any great mission. You've accused an individual that I'm defending, and he's innocent. And you better show that he's not. We don't have to do your work for you. And we're not going to buy your generalization about what happened. We don't know what happened. You tell us. You bring the case. And, well, let's go to the end of the story. Christopher Black prevailed. General Dindi Limana was found not guilty. So it's an important part of this to think where it started. When he began to defend General Dindi Limana, the Globe and Mail did a very high-profile article about him. You could look it up. And they had a lovely picture of Chris, but the title on the piece was The Devil's Advocate, working off the old Dallaire story about how he had shaken hands with the devil, which is, I was there when he gave his first speech and said that, used that line. Dallaire has a flair for the dramatic. He says so in his book about the events. He brags about being somebody who knows how to put on a show, as it were. I shouldn't go too far into that story because it makes me more heated. But Chris Black was called the devil's advocate. Well, as often happens, the devil does pretty well in court because Dindi Limana was not a devil. He is an excellent individual. One of his strongest admirers and supporters is somebody who really knows and who testified for him. And that was Colonel Marchand. Who is he? Colonel Marchand was the UN officer from Belgium who was responsible for security for the city the capital city of Rwanda, Kigali. And so he was in day-to-day contact with General Dindi Limana. And he knew that he appreciated the fact he got cooperation. He never had a problem with him, found him truthful. He testified on behalf of General Dindi Limana. That helped a lot. There's a tragedy in the story that is not often mentioned. I knew General Dindi Limana's son in Brussels, and his wife and family. He had a wonderful son, a very intelligent young man who cared a lot about his father, believed in his father. He developed cancer. And after General Dindilimano was forcibly removed from Belgium, taken, well, I say forcibly, he cooperated. He was taken to Arusha for the trial. His son became very, very ill. And General Dindilimana asked if he could see him because the son was dying, and he was refused. This is a man who was shown after years to be innocent. He was in prison for years, waiting trial, and then during the trial, he was one of four accused. Incidentally, all four of those army officers that they put on trial eventually were cleared. Put that in your pipe and smoke it, as they say. It was thanks to the talent and persistence and true integrity of a lawyer who didn't buy all the front pages and all the wonderful books written by morons about what happened in Rwanda. He said, come to court and let's see if you know what you're talking about. His client was cleared. If you want to know what he was like as a person, first, he was always a treat to be around, and he had great humor. He was very, very well read. He wrote a lot. I urge you to read his writing. But there was a movie made a few years back called Richard Jewell. It was directed by, of all people, Clint Eastwood. Richard Jewell was accused of being the Atlanta bomber in a case where at the Olympics a bomb went off, and the police, after a couple of days, decided it must have been this guy Jewell who was, they had done a profile on him and decided he had the kind of personality that would have done that. And so they immediately, everybody developed what they called tunnel vision, and they circled his name and they ran him through the mud. And they said he was going to, you know, they were going to prove that he had committed the crime of the bomb. And a lawyer took it up. And that lawyer, if you watch the film, I swear, the personality of the lawyer is very much Chris Black. And I'm very sorry to say, I meant always to tell him that. I wanted to tell him, hey, you're like that lawyer, because he resembled him, both physically and in his manner, but definitely his attitude. He's a fighting, scrappy lawyer with a good sense of humor and no great faith in this lovely thing we all call the system. No faith in it at all. And so if you see the movie, it's called Richard Jewell. You will be looking at and you see the defense lawyer, you will be, and the way he instructed his client and the way he handled himself, particularly with the media, and the way he behaved in court, and his advice to his client was brilliant. And it is, that's Christopher Black, actually. I wish I had told him that, because it was on. Every time I saw the film, I thought, gee, that guy's a lot like Chris Black. Of course, Chris Black was, I want to go all the way back, one of the lawyers that I knew when working for Charles Roach at the Roach Schwartz firm, now gone, and Charles is deceased. He set the tone, because Charles was soft-spoken, good-humored, and courageous lawyer, and he attracted similar people. He attracted Chris Black, he attracted Peter Rosenthal and others. And so Charles Roach had a lot to do with fighting for the accused at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. And if you read the record of the court, you'll see that he put a tremendous dent in the presumption of guilt that went on with the tribunal, and also they corrected the historical record. For anybody who wants to know, you have to read the record. And Chris was very big on that. He said, let's have a look at the record. And by the way, we particularly like, we want to know about all those passages which have been blacked out. On, you get a document and accusing your client, and only one third of the text is available for your eyes. And they say that for the interest of security, they can't share everything with you. Anyway, it's a long way around to talking about Chris Black. Chris Black was our contemporary, and the battles we wage now are, have the spirit and I hope the intellect and of Christopher Black. This is the Taylor Report. It is CIUT 89.5 FM at 6 p.m. tonight. Young and Bloor, there will be a protest against the illegal boarding of the ship that was trying to is trying to bring aid to Gaza. It's a crime, of course, to help the people of Gaza, according to the NATO gang. We're going to take, I guess, a musical break, if Pedro permits, and we'll come back. We're going to be talking to David Sobel. This is Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. And in the time remaining, I'm going to remind you again, there's a 6 o'clock tonight, Monday, there's going to be a demonstration against the boarding, illegal boarding of a vessel, which there are people, several, I don't want to go through all the names. So, you know, the crucial thing here is that there's been a Freedom Flotilla for a long time, for years, and the Heap family has contributed tremendously to this. They've all been part of trying to bring aid and of course, truth into what is the situation in Gaza. And, but the, once again, one of the ships has been boarded, and we don't know the fate of the crew, people. There's been a lot of bloody-minded commentary from reactionaries. One American senator, I think it was, said, I hope they can swim, some kind of ugly thing like that. When you have episodes such as that taking place in Gaza, a siege, basically, according to the prime minister himself, a siege, no air, no electricity, no food, no water, it was out of their own mouths. We all heard it, so we don't need some authority on human rights to talk about it. Anybody can tell you that it's a crime to treat the people of Gaza the way they're being treated. So at 6 o'clock tonight, there'll be this a demonstration. I want to call attention to the what I call, very simply, the growing war danger. The headline in the Globe is Ottawa is going to hit its 2% for NATO next year. So it's all hurry up and don't miss the war is the philosophy. And everyone is running toward it as though somehow it's like moths to a fire. It's so smart to just more and more armament. We talked about it on the program last week that the prime minister says we're not going to be the 51st state. And the way that we avoid that, apparently, is behave as though we were. Behave as though we are a vassal and we will. Trump can tell us he's going to do this to us and that to us, and we say, okay, but I get to be part of your defense system. And he says, well, maybe you'll have to pay. Somebody who can't be trusted, the biggest problem in all of the conflicts, whether it's Gaza, Ukraine, other areas of conflict which could flame out of control, we have a state which can't even trust itself. Why should we trust it? You see the two brothers embracing, and then you see them fighting in the back room, Musk, Trump, and others. And these are the individuals who, at the controls in terms of peace or war, escalation, de-escalation, and also who say they want agreements. But this agreements that go through Washington are basically the road to hell. And Canadians know that, and they kind of hope their prime minister does, but there's no sign that he gets it. And an illustration would be the tariffs, policy on tariffs towards steel. Canada got very mad, or they tell us, Canadians certainly are mad, that the heavy tariffs are being directed at steel and aluminum by the Americans. And the way they expressed it was for Ms. Jolie to say that we're going to really clamp down on South Korea and Turkey and, most importantly, China. We're going to really clamp down on them for dumping. In the Globe and Mail business section, an individual who is in the business commented. He said, "This is not elbows up. This is sucking up, and that is 51st state behavior. 51st state behavior, not elbows up. It is sucking up. This is a Canadian billionaire. We got our own. And our oligarch said, he wasn't the page one guy. Of course, Ms. Jolie had the front page by saying, we're so angry at the tariff situation that we're going to make problems for China. Well, she's actually on cue because the U.S. ambassador to Canada and Trump all say, if you, Canada, want to be acceptable to us, not make us angry, which is number one issue for all Canadian politicians, don't make him angry. If you want to get along, you're going to have to make an issue about China. China isn't doing anything to anybody. And if you want to solve the problem, there is the World Trade Organization. China's a member. We're a member. So go there and sort it out, because that's why it's there. But instead, it's we're getting this kind of obedience training where they have to maintain the legend, myth, lie that they're going to stand up to Trump while doing every damn thing he asks. That's something to meditate on. And by the way, the people of Los Angeles might be our leaders at the moment. Take a look. We've talked about it on the show. We're coming to the end of the show, by the way. We've come to that the people of the Southwest are indigenous and Latin, largely Mexican Americans. And Donald Trump wants to fight them, and he's fighting them, frankly, in the name of white supremacy. And you want to see trouble, you got it, pal. And those people are stronger than Mr. Trump, I guarantee you. This is the Taylor Report. Again, sorry to say that Christopher Black has died. We'll be talking to his friends and others in future shows. And Steve Fruitman is coming up at 33, 44, 44, 45, 78. It's a great show. And thanks, Pedro.